Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Junior Lawyers Against Poverty at UCL's initiative, In Conversation With, wherein we interview accomplished individuals from the legal sphere, such as judges, lawyers, barristers, and so on. I am Sahana Karthik, the president of the GLAP chapter at UCL, and today I am honored to have with me someone who really needs no introduction, the Right Honorable Lord Justice Zingerman. He is a judge in the Court of Appeal. He's also a recently appointed lead judge of international relations, and he has also served as a high court judge. Lord Dingerman, we are very, very happy to have you here today.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Yeah. So we'll just jump straight into the questions. So you were initially a barrister, as I mentioned, and you later undertook the role of a high court judge in 2013, and then you were appointed as a Court of Appeal judge in 2019. And you were also appointed as a lead judge for international relations in February of this year. So could you kind of elaborate on the changes that accompanied the change in your role in terms of the responsibility and the nature of the work that you undertook? And did you find yourself needing to adapt to cope with these changes?
Well, I started off, like everyone does, as a law student, and particularly enjoyed constitutional law. Bizarrely, I just enjoyed the interrelationship of politics and the judiciary and the principal areas that the judiciary and the legislature and the executive act and occupy in any society. And then was lucky enough to get taken on as a pupil barrister and became a tenant, and then just started practice. And the skills that you acquire doing that are very much those that carry on throughout the whole of your career. But obviously when I started as a student, I had no thought of becoming a judge. And even when I was a practitioner, I didn't particularly think about becoming a judge. But you are producing pieces of work, analyzing legal situations and attempting as a barrister, obviously, to get the best possible result for your clients.
Yeah, just before we started the interview, we were speaking a little bit about the effect that the pandemic had on my education. And I'm sure it's had a massive, it's made a massive difference in the way that the way that you try into your cases. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Oh, of course. So within about a week of the first lockdown in the United Kingdom, we'd managed to put about 90% of the Court of Appeals work online through remote hearings. The Queen's Bench Division, where I was a High Court judge beforehand, about 80 to 90% of its work went online. And the legal practitioners were all excellent at cooperating, becoming experts at Zoom, then Teams, then Skype for Business, and now we have CVP, which is the cloud video platform. We were able to keep a lot going. The particular difficulty was with jury trials, where obviously you need everyone in the same room. And that was difficult. Some family court cases had particular difficulties where it was only fair that people be heard in person. But by and large, the courts have managed to keep sitting, albeit using a lot more technology than there was beforehand.
Yeah, I think it was very interesting to also, just scrolling through LinkedIn, you read all of these stories from judges about how much they've changed, and they have photos that they put up of their workspaces. And it's very nice to see that we can all relate on a certain level. What was really interesting to me was also the fact that you were the first member in your family to enter the legal profession. And you also grew up as a naval child, and you lived in Singapore, Plymouth, Sussex, Scotland, and Gibraltar. You also initially studied in a state primary school. So were there any challenges that having a non-legal familial background and traveling so much as a child posed to you as you entered this profession? And how do you think those experiences or challenges, if you had any, how do you think those shaped your career?
I certainly think living abroad a lot gave me a different perspective from those who'd been in the UK all their lives. And at the time I was going to university, my parents were in Gibraltar because my father was, as you point out, naval officer. So my parents were living down there. But a lot of the friends I met down there were Gibraltarians who were themselves studying law. So it was a very good introduction to life. And politics in some smaller jurisdictions can be disproportionately affected by the number of lawyers who are involved both in politics and law. I mean, there's obviously been a long crossover between politicians and lawyers, but it was very interesting to see that in the dynamics of Gibraltar in particular. As far as not having any background in the law was concerned, I think I was very lucky at university. I met the Inner Temple Student Society, which came out on a visit, and they were extremely helpful about saying, this is the route you ought to follow, these are the things you ought to think about doing. And it was partly for that reason that I was very keen on the Inner Temple Outreach Society to ensure that those who don't come from legal backgrounds have no knowledge of the law, or most importantly, are not thinking about the law at all, at least encouraged to think about it as a potential career option.
Yeah, and in you mentioned, you know, things that you ought to think about when you become a judge or when you become a lawyer. And it's one of the important things that is often overlooked is the emotional toll that cases can take on judges, especially when you're trying, you know, murder cases or those with a sexual motive. And it's the expectation that you have to remain unbiased and avoid allowing this emotional impact of your work to affect your personal life. So this expectation is one that many, you know, people might find difficult to understand or comprehend. And in trying so many cases, what would you say is that effect of that on you as a judge?
Well, I think for all those involved, from the police investigating, from the legal representatives on both sides, for the defendant, and for the prosecution, and then for the jury in particular, who are taken off the streets to hear some really very grim evidence, and then the judges, it's difficult for all. I was a presiding judge on the Western Circuit, which meant that I was effectively responsible for managing about 130 judges, district judges and circuit judges. The circuit judges, many of them sat hearing criminal cases. But there were some court centres that we had on the circuit, on the Western Circuit, where their diet of work was very much sexual offending work. And it became necessary to move judges in and out of those particular courts to give them some variety, because otherwise a diet of hearing unrelenting sexual offending cases can be difficult for anyone.
Thank you so much. So we were also introduced to you through Catherine from the Flynn Foundation, which you've been a trustee of since 2010. And the foundation is an amazing educational charity which works with senior judges and justice institutions around the world to improve justice systems and the rule of law. So the importance of your court to pro bono work, you know, it's very clear. You've been involved in multiple imperative pro bono cases, and most notably in appealing against a sentence of death in Bernard versus the state, and also in challenging the constitutionality of the mandatory sentence of death in Miguel versus Trinidad and Tobago. So why is it that pro bono work remains at the heart of your career? And do you believe that it is necessary for law students to involve themselves with such projects from an early stage? And why do you think so?
Well, a number of questions there. Yes, I think pro bono is vital, because if you're lucky enough to become a member of the profession, there will, notwithstanding legal aid systems, always be those who are not represented. I did pro bono death row work in particular because the chambers I joined did a lot of work in the Privy Council, and the Privy Council remained the final court of appeal for many of the jurisdictions which retained the death penalty. And so starting off on Privy Council work, people started to instruct me to do some of the petitions. And then people in prisons inevitably are a source of information for other prisoners. And I would get letters from death row in Trinidad and Tobago saying, dear sir, blessings and honor to you and all your staff, because there was effectively a prison scribe that wrote in the same style to everyone, although I'm not sure what staff he thought I had. Please, will you represent me on my appeal to the Privy Council? And I responded to all the letters and managed to involve, refer them to lawyers, solicitors in London who were able to get the papers and then instruct me, and who did a great deal of excellent pro bono work. in setting up the petition, so we could petition for special leave to appeal, and if we got leave to appeal, then pursue the appeal. And I became involved in the Slim Foundation because at the time I was chairman of the International Committee of the Bar Council, partly because of the international work that I'd done around the world just as a barrister. And we did a project in Albania on reforming their legal profession, which was trying to help them set up a functioning disciplinary system. They had a problem there with some lawyers that it was said were corrupting judges and judges demanding fees from lawyers. And there was no effective system that they were able to bring disciplinary proceedings against lawyers. So we redrafted the model laws that they'd been given, showed them how our system of discipline worked in the England and Wales. And they all came over and visited. And by the end of the project, they had a system of functioning disciplinary procedures, which was, in fact, at the time, the only functioning system in the Balkan states.
That's absolutely fantastic to hear. And I think, you know, you've told us about your legal career and the pro bono cases that you've taken on as well. And that's really interesting. And equally as interesting is the fact that outside of your legal career, you're also incredibly passionate about rugby union, and you've played the sport for a number of years. So you've kind of married your interests, and you've even been selected as a judicial and appeal officer by the World Rugby for the Rugby World Cup in Japan. So law students often overlook the pertinence of investing time into non-legal hobbies and interests. So would you say that there were any transferable skills that you've gained from playing rugby union? And how can a law student effectively balance the time that they dedicate to the law and to the external interests?
Well, I do think it is vital to have external interests as a lawyer, because otherwise, if you only study law, you only bring law to the law. Whereas with other interests, you will inevitably bring your experiences from those other interests to the law. As far as rugby was concerned, I always particularly enjoyed it, and it was a great release, because if you're about to prop down in a scrum, you can hardly be thinking about a case or whether this line of authorities is reasonable or wrong, et cetera. When I became too old to continue playing, I then became involved in rugby discipline. And that is, so if you punch someone and get sent off, you appear in front of a panel of three. I'm not suggesting you would do that, of course. A panel of three on a Tuesday night, and would be imposed a sanction. And if you're unhappy with that, or the regulatory body, the RFU, were unhappy, there would be an appeal on a Thursday night. And so that was using the law, albeit wholly unpaid, in a setting. And it certainly did assist, so that when I became, for example, the presiding judge on the Western Circuit, I had before had the leadership of the independent judiciary for the RFU. And those are leadership skills. Leading judges is a slightly different skill from leading in other areas of society.
Yeah, at UCL, you know, we have a fantastic law society that really focuses on sports as well. And I think we're very lucky to have that, seeing, as you've said, there are so many things to be learned from playing sports or just having external hobbies in general. So is there any other advice that you would have for law students or young lawyers as to how to navigate their career and make significant contributions the way that you've done?
Well, I wouldn't say I made any significant contribution. I think the most important thing is to choose an area of law that you're interested in. I said at the beginning I'd always been fascinated by constitutional law, and that led into working on written constitutions around the Commonwealth, which was a great privilege to travel around and advise and act against Commonwealth governments with written constitutions. And I think because I was interested in it, you are then likely to spend time reading around the subject in a way that you wouldn't if you don't have an interest in it. So, for example, I don't know if you know Blaustein's Constitutions of the World, but they have up in Middle Temple Library a whole series of Blaustein's Constitutions of the World. Very interesting to read some of the introductory letters and paragraphs, because, again, that gives you perspectives that you won't always get just from, you know, reading on the internet the latest version of the constitution for that particular jurisdiction. So I think the probably the best advice I can give is to choose an area of law that you're interested in, because you will, one, enjoy it, and, you know, all being well, you will have a career for 40, 50, 60 years, so you might as well be enjoying it. And secondly, you're bound to be better at it if you've chosen an area that you enjoy.
Yeah, and I think it certainly makes readings a lot easier as well if you're studying something that you really enjoy. Thank you so much, Lord Dingerman. We really enjoyed having you here today. Your insight was invaluable, and we're sure that all of our peers will feel the same way as well. Thank you again.
Well, it's my privilege. Thank you very much indeed.